So somebody asked a question about the necessity of the public information request as regards to the DA's file. All I can say about that, I'm no expert on PIA, but I will tell you that as long as the file is closed, meaning it's not open and pending, then it is subject to an information, Public Information Act request. And I've actually had to go and dig through all of that statutory language for prosecutors' offices who were refusing to turn over the entire file. So, but push comes to shove, they turn over the entire file, excluding those things that are privileged or otherwise not discoverable. So I hope that answers the question. So the trial lawyer's file put a request in writing in my paper. I put exactly what I write in every single email I've ever sent to every trial lawyer. It essentially says that I'm requesting the entire file, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that it's subject to and that you're required to provide it under Texas Disciplinary Rule 1.15D. That a reasonable period of time is expected for compliance. I usually put 10 days. Seems good for PIA, seems good for me. And last but not least, expect delays, expect lawyers not to comply and expect them to be more difficult than you might imagine when you're asking for that file. Maybe it's me because they know what I do for a living, but they are not as forthcoming as you might think when you're requesting the file. So I am polite, but I am persistent about it. And I do not file grievances when lawyers do not turn over their file, although they are subject to a grievance, because again, pursuant to the disciplinary rules, they must turn over the file. And as a basis for that, let me be clear, that file does not belong to the lawyer. The file belongs to the client, and that's why they can't hold on to it and not turn it over when the client is asking for it through me or through Rick Counsel. I have had clients who have filed grievances against lawyers who have not turned over the file, and they were not happy about it. So that's a thing. So making sure that you get the file in every case is critical. And again, making sure that your request is in writing so that you can memorialize that request is also important as a writ practitioner. Last but not least, and certainly not to be overlooked, is family, friends, and other evidence. Affidavits from individuals by way of example who were ready, willing, and able to testify at a sentencing hearing but were never contacted or called is a common claim, as a lot of trial lawyers don't prepare as they should for sentencing. So contacting the family and friends to get that information is something that you would want for a certain type of writ that deals with sentencing. Communications with trial counsel. You know, today's technologically advanced world, I get all kinds of text messages, emails, recordings of phone calls. Clients are taking every opportunity to memorialize communications more and more. And so those things are available to me as their writ counsel to, you know, evidence what they say went wrong. And any other information that might be out there that's available through the family and through others who may have information. Again, you know, you are collecting things that weren't inside the trial court, were not inside the record. And those are the things that we're focused on in writ practice. So they're going to be found in the most unusual places. And so I always contact the family and I always reach out and ask them to give me whatever they have. And oftentimes it's more helpful than hurtful. So okay, let's talk about discovery. Little known thing that some people don't believe in. It's not a myth. 3914 does apply to writ practice as it would under any circumstance where, again, the purpose of the Michael Morton Act is to avoid or prevent wrongful convictions. Well, in writ practice, it's absolutely critical that we have information that is exculpatory or that would otherwise exonerate our client or diminish the guilt or innocence of that person. 3914 under the standard rules says that the prosecutor has an obligation to turn that evidence over as soon as practical if it's within their possession. And so I've dealt with a lot of prosecutors in writ practice who don't think 3914 applies, and they certainly don't comply with 3914 until it's too late for me and we're at a hearing. And at that time, they're producing evidence I've never seen before. Obviously, as a writ practitioner, I have an obligation to work my case up to know as much as I can and then file a writ in good faith based on what I believe to be the available evidence. And it can't be more frustrating to find out that there's some evidence that, you know, completely undermines my entire defensive theory to be presented at a hearing by a prosecutor who didn't think that there was an obligation to turn it over. So I tell people and I file a written request admonishing them of their 3914 obligation so that if they don't believe that they have one, we can litigate that in the trial court before we've gotten so far along. And then it's specifically under 3914H, which is the provision that I think is most applicable in post-conviction practice, again, talks about exculpatory impeachment, mitigation documents, items, and information. And so these cases that go up to the Court of Criminal Appeals will continue to guide us on 3914, its applicability and how it will work in different cases. But again, my position would be that, you know, if Michael Morton was set up for the purpose of preventing wrongful convictions, how more important could that be at a time when we're looking into post-conviction issues that we believe present a wrongful conviction or a wrongful sentence?